Thanks for tuning in for the July 6th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Near Immunology and Inflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Josep Dalmau talks about the neuropsychiatric features and frequency of NMDAR and other neuronal IgG antibodies in patients experiencing their first psychotic episode, and the role of warning signs and criteria for autoimmune psychosis in this setting. In our What's Trending segment, neurologist Dr. Daniel Gibbs will tell us how he faced his own Alzheimer's disease diagnosis and his experience participating in a clinical trial for aducanumab.
This is Greg Day from Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Josep Dalmau, a renowned clinical researcher who has made outstanding contributions in the field of neurology in general and immune-mediated brain diseases specifically. Josep is a distinguished professor at the University of Barcelona in Spain and Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also the senior author on a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled Clinical Neuroimmunologic and CSF Investigations in First Episode Psychoses. Josep, thanks for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure. In 2007, your clinical research team described the important roles of autoantibodies against central nervous system NMDA receptors, causing psychosis and encephalitis. And ultimately, this led you and your team to establish anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis as a novel and potentially treatable cause of new onset psychoses. This publication, I think, represents another big step forward, detailing the clinical, neuroimmunologic, and CSF findings in 105 patients with first episode psychoses. Could you summarize the key findings from this important study?
Yes, well, thank you. Thank you, Greg, for the introduction. As you mentioned, anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis and its association with pathogenic autoantibodies against the NMDA receptor was discovered in 2007. The fact that many of these patients initially present with psychosis led some investigators to believe that similar antibodies occur in patients with primary psychiatric diseases. This has resulted in many reports on antibody testing in all kinds of psychiatric diseases, and including, of course, first episode psychosis. Most of these studies have, in our opinion, have important methodological problems. For example, most do not use the same testing methods, including validation of the findings with more than one test, or do not include studies in CSF, as is done for anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. So we decided to study 105 consecutive patients seen at our institution for first episode psychosis. Patients were comprehensively examined by psychiatrists and by neurologists, and all were tested for neuronal antibodies in serum and in CSF, and using four different methods. All tests and all patients were antibody negative. In addition, we assessed the performance of two sets of reported warning signs for autoimmune psychosis, sometimes called red flags or yellow flags for autoimmune psychosis, and a set of recently published criteria for autoimmune psychosis. Surprisingly, neither of the sets of warning signs or the criteria for autoimmune psychosis was useful in patients with pure or isolated psychosis. The problem of these criteria is that they are heavily dependent on the presence of neurologic or systemic symptoms. So they were of very limited help in patients with isolated psychiatric symptoms. For example, during the study, there were three patients referred to our clinic with genuine anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis who presented with isolated psychosis. The criteria failed to identify two of the three cases as autoimmune. Because of all of these, we propose an algorithm based in reported experience with an NMDA receptor and other autoimmune encephalitis that we believe that helps to identify the cases that present with first onset psychosis.
Thank you for that excellent summary. And you've detailed the methodologic advances in this study very well, and I think some of the ways that it's going to help us to address our challenges. Of course, a study of this nature, though, must also have been challenging to do. Obtaining spinal fluid in particular from 105 patients with first episode psychoses is a substantial achievement. And probably a lot of work for you and your team. Why did you decide that it was so critical to study spinal fluid in these patients?
The anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis, which by large is the most frequent cause of psychosis of autoimmune origin, is a disease that needs to be diagnosed with a CSF study. So the CSF studies are critical. Moreover, if the NMDA receptor antibodies are only identified in serum, so that means CSF negative, only found in serum, what should be concerned for the false positive results with the test, and therefore the results are of unclear significance? You have to keep in mind that currently there is not known neurologic or psychiatric syndrome that specifically associates with NMDA receptor antibodies in serum only. None of the studies that have reported NMDA receptor antibodies only in serum of patients with psychiatric diseases have been able to demonstrate distinctive symptoms or substantial differences in the clinical outcome. So let me summarize the problem that has been generated in this field with some numbers. Before our study, there were 11 series of first episode psychosis that had been reported. Of these 11 series, none had the CSF systematically examined. To be more precise even, of 1,150 patients included in these 11 series, only 7 patients had CSF studies. 3 were negative and 4 were positive, and these 4 had clearly NMDA receptor encephalitis. A few weeks ago, a similar study was published, similar study as ours here, but with less clinical information, was published examining the CSF of 103 patients with first episode psychosis. Not surprisingly, all were antibody negative. So here is my question. So what do we do with all these previous reports, systematic reviews, meta-analysis of those reports, editorial comments and opinions that are based on studies in which the diagnosis was not properly established? So this is a real challenge to keep in mind when somebody looks at the field.
I think that's a very clear justification. And I'm also worth noting that access to spinal fluid really obviously distinguishes this study from those that go before it. And I think, and I assume you'll agree, provides a pretty definitive answer to questions about the role of NMDA receptor autoantibodies in first episode psychoses, at least in the patients that your team was able to enroll. This has a lot of practical clinical implications, and I think our audience is going to be very familiar with that. But we as neurologists are frequently called upon in either inpatient or outpatient settings to assess patients with psychiatric presentations with that question of, is this or could this be autoimmune encephalitis? And I know that many of us are reticent to overtest patients. We certainly don't want to undertest patients. How do findings from your work here, how do they inform our approach to the evaluation of patients with new onset psychoses?
Psychosis as a monosymptomatic disorder of autoimmune origin is extremely, extremely rare. As shown in previous studies, psychosis is very frequent. It's the opposite. It's very frequent as the initial presentation of NMDA receptor encephalitis. But patients with this disease usually develop within the next few days or weeks neurological symptoms or paraclinical findings, EEG, MRI, that facilitate the diagnosis. Our study also indicates that it is better to know the disease than to follow criteria for an individual symptom of the disease, like it's psychosis. Psychosis is not a disease, it's a symptom. The latter would be equivalent to try to diagnose Parkinson's disease using hypothetical criteria for tremor of neurodegenerative origin, for example. As far as the literature on autoimmune psychosis is concerned, as I mentioned before, I recommend having a very critical interpretation, given that most of it is based on studies with methodological weaknesses and with non-confirmed diagnosis.
Well, I think you've brought out a few really great points there, and I like your Parkinsonism example. If we translate that to these patients, am I correct in saying, if we're seeing a patient who has pure psychosis, we're going to want to question critically whether that could be something like anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis that we expect to progress and evolve over a relatively short period of time? Is that your take on the situation?
Yes, correct. When you look at patients with previous series, patients with NMDA receptor encephalitis, basically 95% of the patients have EEG abnormalities. The MRI many times is normal, but about 30% have also abnormal MRIs. So when you look at our series, our current series now is very informative on this, because when you look of all these patients, how many had EEG or MRI abnormalities, it's very, very low. I don't remember now the numbers, but were basically below 5%. So here you have this a very helpful clues. With a good neurological exam and clinical history and this routine testing, you really can really have an idea if the patient has more than a primary psychiatric disorder.
And knowing that our goal in the clinic setting or in the hospital setting is, you know, not to do more testing than we need to, how do we use this information to determine which patients with a primary psychiatric presentation, first episode psychosis, which patients need a lumbar puncture to really definitively exclude the possibility of NMDA receptor encephalitis?
Yeah, well, I think that one should start with a careful assessment of the clinical history, as always in medicine, and with a very careful neurological examination, looking at the patient that has a primary psychiatric, let's say, first episode psychosis, looking carefully if they have neurological symptoms. We have to include in the equation EEG, MRI, and of course, general blood and urine chemistry to rule out the most common culprits, like, let's say, toxicological studies and any cause related to drug, for example, induced psychosis. Now, any abnormality in the neurological exam or in the paraclinical neurology test or detection of antibodies in serum, if you test the serum for antibodies, but any abnormality here should lead to routine CSF studies, I mean, the typical routine studies and antibody testing. Any identification of comorbidities in this patient, for example, coexistence of a tumor or recent viral infection, should also lead to CSF testing. If the initial steps of all of these that I mentioned, clinical history, neurological exam, EEG, MRI, they don't show any abnormality, the likelihood of an autoimmune psychosis drops substantially. Even though there are autoimmune encephalitis other than NMDA receptor encephalitis that can present with psychosis, these are really uncommon and usually associated with neurological symptoms or comorbidities from the very beginning. So there are always exceptions, but they are not really very challenging, this as NMDA receptor encephalitis, which is different because these patients often present with prominent, as I mentioned before, prominent isolated psychiatric symptoms and may initially be seen by psychiatrists. As with the other autoimmune encephalitis syndromes, anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis is a neurologic disease that requires, even when presents with pure psychosis, is a neurologic disease that requires CSF testing. Our algorithm that we include in the paper applies the experience gained from anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis and similar diseases, but it has been adapted to patients with psychosis and environments in which the spinal taps are difficult to obtain or to perform upfront. The algorithm leads to CSF studies only when necessary, and it also takes in consideration the caveats and the pitfalls of antibody testing in serum only.
So paraphrasing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but in a patient without clear neurological signs, who doesn't look like they have anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis, who doesn't have an MRI with abnormalities, the patient has an EEG that is normal, and there's nothing obviously wrong in serum screening, perhaps including serum antibodies, that may be a patient that doesn't need a spinal tap at that point in time. Is that accurate?
Right. If there are no comorbidities, for example, if the patient is a young teenager or young woman, then you would do an MRI or CT scan of the pelvis. Of course, if you see then like a cyst, ovarian cyst, large, or something that looks like a teratoma. So you have to put everything in context. And I think people should really focus very much in the syndrome of NMDA receptor encephalitis. Become familiar with the disease. There has been the tendency in this field of becoming more test-dependent and panel-dependent of tests and make the diagnosis based on a serum test. I think that this is like the example of Parkinson before, and get familiar with the disease and then you will understand what you have to do. But yes, things or the possibility of an NMDA receptor encephalitis or an autoimmune cause of psychosis drops substantially if all these tests that you mentioned are negative. They still can be positive, and you have to follow a little bit the patients. The psychiatrists are very good telling you sometimes that, you know, this is a very strange, pure psychiatric syndrome, but is very unusual. And then they try to do a spinal tap.
Well, I appreciate the shout out or siren call to the merits of good clinical characterization and clinical examination. And I think ultimately this is very good news for our patients and good news for our practitioners. I really look forward to seeing how this algorithm performs in clinical practice and to follow up studies that are ultimately going to incorporate more patients with more real life experience. Joseph, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss your findings and for your continued contributions to this rapidly evolving field.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure. Thank you, Greg, and all the listeners. Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Joseph Dalmau, lead author on the paper Clinical Neuroimmunologic and CSF Investigations in First Episode Psychoses, which you can and should read in this week's Neurology.
Hi, I'm Jeff Burns from the University of Kansas Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and today I'm with Daniel Gibbs, a retired neurologist who practiced at Oregon Health and Science University for 25 years. For the last couple of years, Dr. Gibbs has been busy writing about his experience living with his own personal diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Most recently, an interview with Daniel Gibbs was published in JAMA, which caught my attention and the attention of many others. So I'm very excited to have the honor of talking with you today, Dr. Gibbs. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. Well, so you're now 5 years out from your diagnosis, a diagnosis that was made a few years after noticing changes in your sense of smell and then later learning through a genealogy website that you carried two copies of the APOE4 allele. And you've written about your experience in JAMA Neurology. Tell us a little bit about your diagnosis and more importantly, how are you doing today?
Yeah, well, right now I'm really doing fine. I don't think that most anyone would have any idea that I have Alzheimer's disease because I'm still in the early stages and can pass as normal pretty easily. But in retrospect, you know, I think, as I mentioned in the book and in the article in JAMA Neurology, that the first symptoms of Alzheimer's for me occurred over 15 years ago when I first started to notice a decrease in my ability to smell. And of course, at the time, I didn't think anything of it. I just assumed it was normal aging. And then about a year after that, I started to have these strange illusory odors that would come out of nowhere. Stereotypical, they were always the smell of baking bread mixed with perfume. And they would last a few minutes to an hour or more, happening several times a week. No obvious precipitating real odor. And these are called phantosmias, as you know. And I still didn't think very much about it, although in the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, you know, I wonder if I might be slated for getting Parkinson's someday. Because, you know, of course, I knew that 80% of people with idiopathic Parkinson's will have olfactory impairment to some degree. But at the time, I really wasn't aware of the association with Alzheimer's disease. So it wasn't until it would have been 2012 when I accidentally learned that I'm homozygous for the APOE4 allele. And this came about because my wife wanted to get our DNA tested for genealogical purposes. And at the time, this was a direct-to-consumer testing. At the time, there were a number of medically related risk genetic factors listed. And then there was a black box that you had to unlock if you wanted to get the results. And the results in there were for the LRRK2 gene, which, as you know, is the most common genetic cause of Parkinson's disease. And then there was the APOE4 allele. And so I opened it because I was interested to see if I might have a LRRK2 mutation. And I didn't, but I was flabbergasted to find out I was an APOE4 homozygote. Alzheimer's was totally not on my radar screen because both my parents died early from cancer. And as I found later, there were people in the family more distantly who most likely had Alzheimer's, but it just wasn't something I was thinking about.
Right. So yeah, and then you began developing some subtle memory issues that led you to retire at the age of 62, I've read.
Yeah.
And you know, you actually in some of your writings talk about the importance of early diagnosis. As a neurologist, you have a very unique perspective on this with experience in both treating patients, but now as a patient with Alzheimer's disease. And so let's talk a little bit about the importance to you of early diagnosis and what kind of advice do you have for practicing neurologists on recognizing and diagnosing Alzheimer's?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was first in practice, I started practice in 1989. And, you know, for that first decade or so, first 5 years, there was really nothing we could do for Alzheimer's. And so we tended to be reassuring to people that, well, you might have Alzheimer's, but, you know, don't worry about it because it probably isn't, that sort of thing. And then in 1993, you know, Tacrine came out, and then 1996, Aricept came out. And now we had to take it more seriously. But even then, the patients that we saw were late in the disease, and there still wasn't, you know, much that helped. And, you know, what really struck me about my own history was that, you know, I've had Alzheimer's pathology for at least 15 years now, if you accept the fact that my olfactory symptoms were related. And I was absolutely fine for most of that time cognitively. So the early stages of Alzheimer's last decades, amyloidosis starts probably 20 years before cognitive impairment. And it's become apparent to me that this is the time that we can intervene, you know, eventually with medications, perhaps, but right now with lifestyle changes. And, you know, that's been well documented, your work and others, particularly for exercise. The data for dietary prevention is good, not quite as strong as for exercise. And then there are other lifestyle changes, getting adequate sleep, and that's a rising area of interest right now in the lymphatic circulation and how that may help remove amyloid and other toxins, and staying intellectually active and staying socially active. Those are all really important things that we can do and our patients can do, but they have to start it in midlife. And so that's the thing I'm trying to do, is get neurologists and the population in general to shift the thinking for intervention to the pre-cognitive impairment stage, because that's, I think, the sweet spot.
Great. And yeah, I was impressed with one of your, I think, your interview in JAMA, where you mentioned you felt a lot of reassurance, actually surprised to feel some reassurance about the diagnosis, and that you could then have the opportunity to take some proactive steps in your lifestyle and planning. And so I think that is such a great message about early diagnosis. And yeah, we have a long way to go in terms of understanding, you know, these interventions and what we can really do to impact the disease. But, you know, it does start with early diagnosis. So,
yeah. And I should just add the kind of the obvious thing is that the people who need to be particularly tuned into early intervention are the people with family history of Alzheimer's, because that increases the risk dramatically, as you know. And those are the people who need to get off their butt when they're in their 40s and start getting their exercise and watching their diet.
Right. So, okay, great. Well, so moving from lifestyle to medications. So on June 7th, just recently, the drug aducanumab under the brand name Aduhelm was approved by the FDA. And I'm interested in your take on this approval, but first, let's talk about your role as a clinical trial participant in one of the studies that led to its approval. So you've published a case report on yourself, on your own experience with severe amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, also known as ARIA, and which led to you being admitted to the ICU. So tell us a little bit about your participation in the trial and your experience.
Yeah, and let me just correct you for a moment. I was a co-author on that paper, but I really wasn't the main author of the case study. So I was in the ENGAGE trial for the phase 3 trial of aducanumab. So I was in the placebo arm for 18 months. And at the end of that time, there was an open label extension, which I got into. And so I knew I was getting the real medication at that time. I didn't know I had been getting placebo, although I strongly suspected it because of my lack of side effects and the occasional peek I took at my MRI scans and didn't see any ARIA. But when I started the real aducanumab, I know that the dose that is most effective is 10 milligrams per kilogram. With the extension trial, those who had been on placebo were randomized to get either 6 or 10 milligrams per kilogram. And I know now that I was randomized to 6 milligrams per kilogram, but there's a ramp-up period. So I received two doses, two monthly doses of 1 milligram per kilogram, and and two doses of 3 milligrams per kilogram. The point I'm trying to make is I got a very small amount of aducanumab. And after, I think after the second dose, I started to have headaches, but nothing that was very concerning. After the third dose, which is now 3 milligrams, my headaches got worse, but still nothing very concerning. After the fourth dose, I got a little bit of cognitive impairment. And interestingly, I lost the ability to read, and it was alexia without agraphia. But probably because I was a little bit encephalopathic, I didn't really put together the possibility of ARIA. I just thought it was my Alzheimer's getting worse. And then on Christmas Eve of that year, of course, things always happen in the middle of the night, but I got, you know, a thunderclap headache, essentially, in the back of my head. Worst headache I've ever had in my life. And I took my blood pressure, and it was something like 220 over 115, and repeatedly so. And I am hypertensive, but it's well controlled with medication. And so I had my wife take me to the hospital. And by the time we got there, I was unable to give a coherent history. And I was admitted to the ICU for intravenous blood pressure control. And of course, nobody in this community hospital had ever heard of ARIA. And I still wasn't thinking clearly enough to tell them about it. And I called Gil Rabinovich in UCSF, who's one of my neurologists, and it was like midnight. And fortunately, he returned the call because I left a message on his voicemail that said, "Gil, I'm in the ICU. Things are bad. I don't know my number. Call me back." And he did. And so he was able to coordinate the care and start people thinking about ARIA. And it was one of the worst cases of ARIA that's been documented in terms of the widespread edema in really all lobes of the brain, and widespread microhemorrhages, sometimes overlapping with the edema, sometimes independently of the edema. Yeah, and it took, my symptoms actually got worse over the next month, and that's when I was given high-dose steroids, and that almost immediately got rid of my encephalopathy and my headache.
Amazing, yeah. Well, you know, we know it. This is a side effect. This ARIA is a common side effect, but usually it's an imaging, you know, phenomena without symptoms. And obviously for you, it was much worse. And something we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to and look for because of this, you know, Aduhelm is entering the market. And so I'm interested in your thoughts on just looking ahead, speculating what kind of role. There's been a lot of controversy about this approval, but what kind of role do you see Aduhelm playing in the management of patients with Alzheimer's in the coming years?
Well, I think it's going to have a place for sure. I hope that people don't, that neurologists restrict prescribing it to people with early stage disease only. And I'm really worried that because of the blanket approval that was given by the FDA, that it'll be given to people with advanced disease. And there's no reason to think it would be effective there. And there's theoretical reasons to think it might be more damaging. There's more amyloid angiopathy at that time. I think we need to study those people, but not to allow them to have it outside of a study.
Oh, that's great. And that's wise words. And we're all wrestling with this. You know, what's the right patient? And we have to be very careful and responsible and figuring this out. So that's a great perspective. So let's finish with, I think it's amazing that you've also written a memoir called A Tattoo on the Brain that came out earlier this year. So tell us about the book. Tell us about the title, A Tattoo on the Brain.
Yeah, the title actually came to me before I started working on the book. And I came up with a second title later on that was too pedantic and came back to this one. And the meaning of the title really is twofold. There's a literal meaning in that I have hemosiderin deposits that are still present in my brain, you know, from those microhemorrhages. And, you know, that's not unlike tattoo ink. So there's a literal tattoo on my brain. But there's also a figurative tattoo in that tattoos are what we do to make a statement to the world about who we are. And one of the things I really am trying to do is to work on removing the stigma about Alzheimer's disease so that we're not afraid to discuss it with family, with all my neighbors know I have it. You know, we can joke about it. And, you know, we need to move away from that image of Alzheimer's being just the poor person in the nursing home who can't speak anymore, and to think of it as this wide continuum of disease that's, I think, manageable if we start early enough. And we need to talk about that. And so that's the other part of the tattoo.
Well, that's fantastic. And I thank you so much for speaking out. I think it's so important what you're doing. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for writing what you've written and for speaking out.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article that explores the epidemiology of subarachnoid hemorrhage across regions in Finland, as well as a study examining the association of migraine with hypertension in women after menopause. Take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.